How is everyone doing today? Oh, that was a glorious port. I ask nothing more. I expect nothing more. I ask for nothing less. Man, it's great to see you. If you're new to Door of Hope, welcome. My name's Josh. I'm one of the pastors here, and we are in the book of Daniel. And man, Tim and I are just discussing what an amazing book this is because it's such an incredible narrative, and it explains itself. So much of it is easily understood just reading the story and allowing just the elaborate interactions between the characters of the story to speak into our lives. And so today we're going to be tackling Daniel 4. And as we talked about in the beginning, that the purpose of Daniel for us in the age in which we live is we believe that Daniel gives us incredible insight into how to maintain faithfulness in the midst of a culture that is functioning against the very foundations of all that we believe as Christians, as followers of Jesus. And Daniel is a devout and committed follower of Yahweh who maintains his integrity as a follower of Yahweh in the context of the great archetype of all world kingdoms, Babylon. Under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar, the greatest ruler in the world, he is trained and taught all the ways of Babylon, and yet he does that without compromising his commitment to Yahweh. And the great dilemma before us as a modern people, and what we can glean from Daniel, is how do we maintain faithfulness to our king and not be assimilated into our culture, or the other side, how do we maintain faithfulness to our king without cloistering ourselves or trying to hide away from our culture? How do we engage it intelligently, faithfully, fervently, representing Jesus and his kingdom? And I think that Daniel gives us incredible insight into that. Today we're going to be considering a narrative that really doesn't need much commentary, for its themes are universal themes that we are touched by as human beings. And one of the key themes is the dangers of pride and the necessity of humility if we're to actually enjoy the life that we've been given. And humility comes from a recognition that we are not the center of our universes, which is the very thing that our culture declares to us each and every day. The secular age is all about functioning from our own personal experience as the center and foundation of how we actually understand the world in which we live. And so everything is subjective today. And what we're going to find is the story of Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation, his humbling, his discovering that even as the greatest ruler in the world, there is still one who is over all that he has accomplished, all that he is. He owes all of it to the one true God, Yahweh, who will reveal himself in a very intense way, bringing Nebuchadnezzar to his knees. And Nebuchadnezzar, as we're going to find in this chapter, it's from the first person perspective, Nebuchadnezzar writing a detailed account of what happened to him. And what you'll see is here is the greatest ruler in the known world of the greatest kingdom the world has maybe ever known. It was one of the seven wonders of the world. Only Rome really rivaled, but probably nothing rivaled Babylon's beauty. It was known for its hanging gardens. And Nebuchadnezzar, this incredible king who is basically worshipped as a god, is brought to his knees by the one true God. And the power of this narrative is that Nebuchadnezzar seems to speak of his humiliation with an incredible sense of gratitude, viewing it not as God's wrath being poured out on him, but God's mercy intervening in his arrogant life. So I think the best way to do this, because it's 37 verses, just to read through it, and then we're going to just talk about kind of these three ideas of God's providence over all that is, the dangers and the reality of pride as the root of all sin, and the necessity of humility for us to maintain faithfulness in the world that God has placed us. And so beginning in verse 1, it says, King Nebuchadnezzar, and well, if you don't have your Bible, it's going to be up on the slides behind me. It says, King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and the wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. So right out of the gate, we see in these first three verses that something has happened to Nebuchadnezzar, because I don't know if you noticed, but Babylon was a polytheistic empire. It believed in multiple deities, and yet Nebuchadnezzar is speaking about the one true God. He is declaring an allegiance and a recognition of Daniel's God, which is going to unveil for us that something has happened to him. And I love how he says, how great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. His dominion endures from generation to generation. Here is the one whose kingdom is greater than any kingdom in the known world, and yet he is saying that the kingdom of this God is the truly great kingdom. It is the only kingdom that lasts. And this sounds more like Jewish poetry than it does like a Babylonian king, does it not? And Nebuchadnezzar goes on. It says in verse 4, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. Those two phrases, I think we can, as modern people, connect with those statements. And nowhere is danger greater than when you are at ease in your own house and prospering in your palace. I think that one of the challenges for us in Western society, and I think that the great dilemma for us as Christians, is there's something purifying, I will say, about struggling to exist. Literally, just struggling to exist, especially as Christians. I feel like some of the most exciting days in my walk with the Lord were in those early days of just not knowing how we were going to get by, but just knowing that we had been saved and that Jesus was with us. And there was something that knit Maya and Darcy's heart together. And not that it's fun, not that I wish poverty on people, but there is something, as I've noticed every time I visited a third world country, where the possibility of ever actually escaping the economic status of the people who live below poverty, like a place like India. If you're born in a slum, you're going to live and die in a slum. You're not going to escape it. The caste system itself actually denies the possibility of escape unless you're adopted out of that country. And yet, the Christians that I have met in places like Mexico, in the Philippines, in India, in places where it is truly impossible to get by economically or experience any kind of ease or prosper in this place, Jesus just seems a lot bigger to them. There is actually a peacefulness that I wouldn't wish all of my American prosperity upon these Christian communities that I've had the pleasure, because often I've gone to these places to minister to these hurting people that have less, and I'm the one that ends up being ministered to and convicted by the arrogance to think that that our prosperity is what they need, when really what we need is their faith. and I think that this is a place, it's the challenge. This is why Jesus says, how difficult is it for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven? We need to know from a world perspective, we pretty much all sit in the category of rich as Americans. If you don't worry about where you're going to get your next meal or where you're going to sleep tonight, if you're not worried about those things, you already have surpassed the majority of where much of the world lives in the reality that it lives in. And yet, this is one of the great dangers that's at play. Nebuchadnezzar is the most powerful man in the world. Therefore, you can only imagine the ego that is directly connected to that. He says, I saw a dream that made me afraid, and as I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So I made a decree. Here, Nebuchadnezzar is intervening into this godless man's world and revealing himself. And I think this speaks volumes about God's willingness to actually get into the midst of wicked people's lives, because he's a God who loves and wants to rescue even the worst of us. And he says, so I made a decree that all the wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians and the enchanters, the Chaldeans and the astrologers came in, and I told them the dream, but they could not make known to me its interpretation. At last, Daniel came in before me, he who was named Belteshazzar, after the name of my God. Notice he actually points out that Daniel was given a new name, a name that was dedicated to his gods, the false gods. And he says, and in whom the spirit of the holy gods is the spirit of the holy gods. There you see Nebuchadnezzar, up to this point, was still even misunderstanding how it is that Daniel had the ability to interpret dreams properly. He saw that Daniel was embodied by the spirits of the false gods of Babylon. And I told him the dream, saying, and I love this line, don't tell me there's no such thing as a Christian wizard. O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians. There isn't any such thing as a Christian wizard, but there is the possibility of being mistaken for one. Because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you and that no mystery is too difficult for you, tell me the visions of my dream that I saw and their interpretation. The visions of my head as I lay in beds were these. I saw and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heavens. And it was visible to the ends of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful, and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all the flesh was fed from it. So here, the vision of this beautiful tree that seems to be the source of life for all that are near it, for both people and the beasts of the fields. This is a fruitful tree, and trees are often utilized in metaphorically throughout the scriptures to speak of strength and life. And I think it's interesting that this is the vision that God gives to him. It says, I saw in the vision of my head as I lay in bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven, and he proclaimed aloud and said thus, and here's where the dream gets a little disturbing. Beautiful vision, and now it's disrupted by a chainsaw. Chop down the tree and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze. If you cut down a tree, I don't know if you know this, but if you stick a stake of iron into the center of a tree trunk, it keeps it from growing back. So there is not only is it being cut off, but it's now being it's not being completely uprooted, but it is being prevented from growing. And it says the band of iron and bronze amid the tender grass of the field, let him be wet with the dew of heaven, let his portion be with the beasts and the grass of the earth, let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let seven periods of time pass over him. And it says the sentence is by the degree of the watchers, and so here you have messengers on behalf of Yahweh, the decision by the word of the holy ones to the end that the living may know, and this is a key verse that appears three times in this chapter, that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. And so there is a great declaration, something that is held to tenaciously by the church, by followers of Yahweh, by followers of Jesus, is that God's sovereign rule over his creation cannot be prevented even by broken, sinful humanity. That God's purposes and plans for his created order, it will find its fulfillment. And here we see God's sovereign freedom in that he chooses, and this is what he is choosing, to love a sinner in his sin. I think it's interesting. It's that God has not lost control, and it may feel often that God is not in control when we see the darkness that is around us. How do we maintain a balanced understanding of God's providence without falling into the mysterious trappings of then somehow making God responsible for the difficulties that occur? And I think that there is always a tension between God's sovereign will and man's responsibility. And here is one of those fascinating stories that Nebuchadnezzar is being allowed an insight that you are who you are and you have what you have because the God of the universe has allowed it to be so. And I think that this is one of those things that it helps us understand even the element of pride, as we're going to consider soon, is that we can say, well, nothing is worse, but it's such an American thing. I'm a self-made man. You know, I'm a self-made woman. I worked hard. I came from nothing. And you didn't pick your brain. If you're brilliant, you were born with a brilliant brain. You can say, well, I'm self-made. You didn't pick the country you were born in. There are all these things that are completely out of our control. What we make of what has been given to us is another conversation altogether. But there is an ultimate source that we must reckon with, the one who has given us life to begin with. And this is what is coming to Nebuchadnezzar through this dream. And it says, you may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. This is why Paul says that we're to pray for rulers, for there is no ruler that is there apart from God allowing it to be so. He says, this dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of the kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. And then Daniel, whose name is Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and his thoughts alarmed him. As God is giving him revelation, the king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. Now, it's understandable. I want you to think about Daniel's predicament. Here is a young man whose loyalty to Yahweh, God had blessed him in all of his learnings, in his faithfulness to maintain even what we would consider maybe the minutia of the law, but it was a faithfulness that came out of a devotion to the living God. And he is held victim. He is held to the words of God, which he cannot, a true prophet cannot speak that except what God gives to him. And Daniel is troubled because, remember, this king just got done throwing his friends into a furnace for not worshiping him. So if you're a young Jewish man whose courage and bravery before the living God is one thing, but to now still stand before a very physical, real physical threat of a super narcissistic ego who actually believes that he is responsible for the kingdom that he rules and that he should be worshipped as a god, you could understand why Daniel was dismayed. And I think that it's important for us to understand that courage is not the lack of fear, but it is fear under control and is guided by a devotion that surpasses or overrides the fear itself. And Belteshazzar answered and said, my Lord, may the dream be for those who hate you. This is what Daniel's hoping. And its interpretation for your enemies. But then he immediately, as the dream's revealed, has to speak out that which the dream is about, which is about Nebuchadnezzar. The tree you saw, which grew and became strong so that its top reached the heaven, and it was visible to the end of the earth, to the end of the whole earth, whose leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and which was food for all under the beasts of the field, found shade, and whose branches the birds of the heavens lived. It says, it is you, O king, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reaches to heaven, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, and let him be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field till seven periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king. It is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my Lord the king, that you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and seven periods of time shall pass over you till you know, and here is that statement again, till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And as it was commanded to leave the stump of the roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be confirmed for you from the time that you know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. And this is what Daniel is about to do, is he is about to lay out for King Nebuchadnezzar the option of submitting to the word of God come to him, or face the consequences of the refusal to. He doesn't have to learn humility through the school of humiliation. This is why the word has come to him. We need to understand that as followers of Christ is that we have been given the scriptures as a means of guiding us so that we can learn, as even as I've stated before, the reason I read the novels I read and the books that I read is that we can learn lessons from both the successes and the failures of others. We don't have to enter into folly and stupidity to discover the truth of the statement that makes us stupid. And I think that this is what Daniel is trying to get through, but pride has a way of blinding, doesn't it? Pride is the root of all sin. He says, therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins. And what he's saying, notice he uses break off your sins. There's a plurality. He's saying this is the outcome of pride. It's no point in talking to him about pride. He has to help him see that he's proud by understanding of that he's living immorally, by practicing righteousness, which means that he's been unrighteous. He elevated himself as a god. He tries to kill innocent people for not worshiping him. The fact that he wanted worship was folly to begin with. That there is a God in heaven who reveals mystery, and the mystery is this, is that you, O Nebuchadnezzar, are here because God has allowed you to be here and for you to not recognize him, to separate yourself, to cut yourself off from him, has caused you to live in a way that is contrary than his heart toward the world which is under your rule. And therefore, that rule is going to be taken away from you. He says, so break off your sins by practicing righteousness. So he's been unrighteous. The pride leads to unrighteousness and your iniquities by showing mercy. And he's not been merciful. The proud have a difficult time showing empathy or care or concern for anyone but themselves. It's about protecting what they have, the kingdoms that they have built. That there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity. So there's Daniel's warning. He didn't have to experience what he was about to experience. But then it says, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, and the king answered and said, is not this great Babylon? And you think about this king, the greatest empire in the world, all under his rule, treated like a god amongst his people, looking over this kingdom, and he says, is this not great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty? And while the words were still on the king's mouth, and on the king's tongue, in his mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men, and there it is the third time, and gives it to whom he will. Immediately, the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men and ate grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers, and his nails were like birds' claws. I want you to just really quickly, in reading commentaries on the book of Daniel, I think it's completely unnecessary for scholars to try to give some sort of psychological diagnostic on Nebuchadnezzar. For this is a divine, you know, there are people that, you know, have a psychological break with reality and think they're animals. And I'm like, God spoke from heaven. It's unnecessary to me. And it's true. There actually is a new documentary that just came out. I think it's called the Furries or something like that. And it's a group of people, a whole secret society amongst us. One of you might be one of them who live out many of their dark days in animal suits pretending to be animals. I have never ceased to be amazed. That's like that. There's also a documentary of people that are obsessed with My Little Pony. I think they're called bromies or something like that. What is wrong with our world? And I think so. I don't need a diagnostic for a diagnosis for Nebuchadnezzar. God struck him, and he went crazy, and he lived out like a wild animal. And even the description of his body and the conversion of his body to look less than human, to become a beast. And it says, at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven. How fascinating. He went from being looking out over his empire, looking down upon his world, his universe that he had created in his mind. And now he is in the dirt and looking up and discovering that he isn't everything that he thought he was. And he says, I lifted my eyes to heaven and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High. Notice the tone of gratitude. His humiliation has led to a humility. And I praised and honored him who lives forever. No longer is he talking about his gods, the spirit of his gods. He's talking about the creator God, Yahweh himself. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are counted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, which was the ways. You ask, how can a man who's been crazy for 7 years be reestablished as king? That's near Far East, just the way that kingdoms work then. You're not the emperor of Babylon one day. There were plenty of crazy emperors of Rome. They didn't remove them from being emperor. They just were crazy, unfortunately. And he says, my Lord taught me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. This is not a text in which we build some sort of prosperity gospel. We recognize God as the rightful king of the world, and he will give us everything we ever wanted and everything we ever dreamed. I think, once again, that just shows God's freedom to do what he wants in line with his plans and his purposes. And if the Old Testament is marked by material blessing, I would say the New Testament is marked by suffering. So I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise. This is what's important. It's not his kingdom that was restored to him, but it was his mind, a mind that had become illuminated by something that was much, much bigger than him, the source of his life, his existence, and his position in life. I praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. So, there's the chapter. Pretty powerful chapter. Pretty amazing narrative. Well, I want to begin here, and we're not just beginning. We've already begun, so don't worry. This isn't the real beginning now. I want to show you guys a slide. This is this is what I have tattooed on my back. I'm joking. That's me at night. this is a famous painting. <It's> the My Little Pony that didn't make the collection. Scared so many little girls. This is a painting by William Blake, the great poet, one of his etchings from his book of poetry, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And it's his painting of Nebuchadnezzar. And I actually think there's a really profound element of this in this painting, because I think the painting depicts something of the unnaturalness. I mean, look at the claws on his nails and the almost scaly fish-like elements of his skin and the hair growing on his skin and just the unkept and just the wildness of his eyes. And Blake himself was certainly not the most stable poet or artist in human history. He claimed that all of his poems and his paintings came from conversations and visions that he received from angels. Most would say that he was definitely a man who suffered from some kind of psychological break, but it was before you could give a diagnosis. But I think what Blake captures actually is the inhuman quality of insanity. And the reduction that for Nebuchadnezzar to become like one of the beasts of the field, he's not like one of the beasts of the field. He's not. A girl came up to me after service and said, she's like, I love that picture because I love German, and there's a word in German for monster. It's Unmensch, which means unman, It's the very word that C.S. Lewis used in Paralandria to describe Weston when he gives himself to the devil and he becomes a frame of a man. He becomes the unman. And I think that there is something. It's right to see a cow in a field eating grass. But when we try to reduce our own humanity to be like the beast of the field, we don't become like the beast of the field because it's not what we are meant to live like. It's something totally other. And I would argue that the person who refuses to recognize that they owe their existence to something bigger than themselves, that unless we have the Spirit of God within us, we cannot function as God intended us to function. That we may be human beings, but we do not function like human beings because until we have the Spirit of God within us, we function often less than animals. We function like maniacs. This is the history of our world, and pride is always at the root, it seems, of the greatest atrocities committed in humanity. For pride, before the fall comes pride, and I think that pride is often the source of much of the insanity that we see in the world around us. I think there's an incredible quote from Dorothy Sayers from Creator Chaos. She wrote, "It is the sin," speaking of pride, "of trying to be as God. It is the sin that proclaims that man, that human beings can produce out of their own wits and their own impulses, their own imagination, the standards by which they live. That we as people are fitted to be our own judge." And you see, this is the secular age in which we live. We are a culture. We are a society that prides itself on its individualism. We are defined by the need to be set apart from everyone around us, to be unique, to be admired, to be worshipped, to be famous. If fame is on the forefront of most young people's ambitions today, that is problematic if we compare that to what was considered the great generation of those who fought in the world wars. And what we see through the 20th century was an ever-increasing movement away from the moral guard of the Christian faith in an attempt to release ourselves from the tyranny of a moral God and to define for ourselves what existence means from a new center, the center of the ego. And with that, it gave birth to so much destruction. The 20th century is the bloodiest time in human history. And I think that this is an incredible reality because we have to fight against this because it infects the church. That even Christianity has turned into a vain pursuit where Jesus and worship of Jesus is nothing more than the idolatry of God. Where we put Jesus in a position of worship only that we might receive from him something that will further elevate our own ambitions, our own dreams, and our own desires. But that is still pride. I want to give you really just three definitions of pride, I think, or three outcomes of pride. That pride, it drains empathy, it's always threatened, and it robs us of joy. I mean, when we think about pride draining empathy, I think we should always be weary of people that feel nothing. You know, the definition of a sociopath is a person that actually does not feel, has no emotions, has not the ability to relate to another person's pain. But see, with the emphasis upon the individual, we live in an age where narcissism isn't so much a sickness as a societal dilemma, where we are the most important thing in our existence. And all we have to do, we just have to look at everything our culture has given us in our attempts to navigate modern society. Everything now in culture is created and shaped for you to be able to create your own universe in which you exist. Think about how social media, all of it, all of the things, all the devices that we use, everything is meant to put everything at your fingertips so that you can keep yourself at the center of your existence. You have your playlists. You have your fans, your followers. You think that the meals that you eat are interesting enough to actually share with the world. We have our blogs and because our thoughts are interesting enough that everybody wants to read them. We have our Twitters because we can say more in a few words than anyone else can say. We now have our own photo section in our photos on our phone that tells us how many selfies we have taken, which I added up the selfies because Darcy and I have a shared account, and it was Hattie who actually took the most selfies. There was like one time in the car, she took like 50 photos of herself with my phone, and I didn't even know it. But I don't think they were really selfies because all of them were really like ridiculous faces that she would never want to go out to the world. So I don't know if that counts. But you understand what I'm saying. This is the age at which we live. I can't even imagine what my son and my daughter, how different their view of the world is because they have a completely different lens than even what I had as a kid. I didn't even have the internet. The internet didn't even come around till I was already, readily available till I was in my mid-20s. I didn't have a cell phone until I was almost 30. So this is a different age. Pride drains us of empathy because it puts us at the center. It's difficult to feel much for others because we're too busy protecting our own hearts, our own position in life. Pride cannot weep with those who weep. It can't laugh with those who laugh. Pride is always threatened. The moment you are your own God, the moment you think that what you do is better than anyone else, you are now put into a position, into a defensive place in life where you have to protect your position. I was watching a series of videos. I became fascinated. I actually came upon him by accident. I don't watch MMA. But do you guys know who Colin McGregor is? Colin McGregor is the best featherweight fighter. But he's like the Muhammad Ali of MMA. He talks the talk. He's handsome. He always wears these ridiculously over the top designer suits. He makes $48,000 a second. What? For getting in a cage. And he started at 19. He's 26 years old. Millions and millions of dollars. And he makes statements like, I am MMA. And 17, his first 17 fights, he won all of them by knockout, every one of them. He took out the world featherweight champion in 16 seconds. He's Irish, so he's got the cool accent, and he thinks he's amazing, and he wants the world to think so as well. He has a watch that like every piece of it is like gold and diamonds. I could not read the time when he showed it on the screen because it was so much flash and bling. Even I was like, ooh, shiny. It's like everything about him is just this incredible ego. So he has set himself up to be the greatest fighter in the world. And what does that mean for him? What's going to happen eventually? He's going to lose. Weird. He just happened to lose his first fight, March 6th. Second round, he got punched in the face. He thought he was so awesome as a featherweight, he thought he'd take the next weight class up and be the first MMA fighter in the world to have the belt in two different weight classes. And he got punched in the face in round two, and it dazed him, and the guy got him on the ground and put him in a head and arm, and it was over in 30 seconds. And he just, there was this, like, it looked like he was going to cry. And this dude is, like, crazy. Even I made Darcy watch. She's like, I can't stop watching. He's so insane and so egocentric. It is like watching a crazy animal. Even I felt bad. I'm like, I kind of wanted him to win. But that's the thing, pride is always threatened. It cannot bear being in the presence of someone better. I've been reading through The Sun Also Rises by Hemingway. I've never been a big Hemingway fan, so I thought I'd give this one a chance. And I actually have enjoyed this book because it's really just an insight into the beginnings of what we're talking about today. As the expats, all the enlightened intellectuals living out their days in Paris. And Hemingway killed himself, shot himself in the head at 61 years old because he was such a drunk that he had lost his ability to write, and he was so obsessed with being the greatest writer in the world that the moment he lost the thing that he thought he was best at, he saw no reason to live. Shot himself with his wife in the room next to him. And I think that this is the depiction, the dilemma, that pride is always threatened. It can't bear being in the presence of someone better. The whole premise, what inspired him to write The Sun Also Rises, is that he was jealous of a friend, a Jewish friend in Paris, who had slept with a girl that he liked, and so he wrote an entire novel to basically tear him apart. And it became The New Voice of America. Not surprising that becomes the great voice, the great picture of American individuality, the great American voice that declares its own awesomeness before the world and dares the world to challenge us. Pride robs you of joy, and that is the essence. Why would Hemingway take his life? Why would Robin Williams take his life? Why do we see this played out again and again of the despair that happens amongst those who reach to the tops of human ambition and they never find anything there that keeps them content? Because it robs us of joy, because you believe everything in life is owed you, and the moment it doesn't work out the way you thought it should is the moment you feel that you have been wronged, and it creates, I believe, the restlessness and the anxieties and the drives that destroy so many lives. We have to ask the question of how do we overcome this? How do we overcome this? Well, humility is the answer. It's the antithesis. And humility, if I can get the next slide, humility begins, first of all, with the recognition that everything I am and possess, I have received from God through Jesus. This is the essence of this chapter. Now, this is the thing, is that it's very easy to fall into the trapping of what I call cosmic plagiarism. It's when you believe you're the author of your own life. Humility begins with the ability to look up instead of down. It's the ability to see the need. I recognize that everything I am, everything I have, I have to give my allegiance to this one who created me. Any gift I might find in myself, any strength that I might have, anything that I have accomplished, all of it ultimately goes back to something I cannot take credit for. And I think that this is important because we live in a time, and the secular age is all about creating a frame of reference from one's own center, and this is why people are so desperately lost today. When Thoreau said that the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation, that is so prophetic because he had no idea of what was coming. He spoke that in a time where people seemed actually quite sane. And yet the insanity of the day in which we live is that we have been taught, trained, conditioned to define our existence from our own center. And it is so problematic. It's why we are so desperately broken. People accuse Christianity of being a religion for the weak because they say it is out of weakness that you are unable to define your own life, and it is out of weakness that you need something bigger than yourself to even find purpose for your existence. And I say, yes, that's true. But I believe that it is having a center outside of myself that is what gives my life any sort of semblance of equilibrium or sanity at all. It begins with a recognition that everything I am, everything I have, comes from another. In fact, this is what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 7. What do you have that you did not receive? If then you received it, why do you boast as if you did not receive it? Paul's telling the Corinthians, who have become spiritually proud. They had come to a place where they believed that even the gifts of the Spirit were something that they should be elevated in. Nothing is more disgusting than pride amongst Christians. And yet it's the one sin that we seem to turn the other cheek on more than any other, while leader after leader after leader of churches just blow their churches up and their entire communities because they began to believe that as the church grew and people came to listen to them talk, that it was something innately in them that made them worthy of the admiration of others. Pride comes before the fall, and it will catch us. It will catch up to us. If you go to the next slide, this is even a more powerful. 1 Timothy 6:17, as for the rich in the present age, charge them not to be haughty, don't be proud, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. Notice, pride is the essence of sin. Remember what sin is. Sin is not the little things that we do wrong. Sin is that rejection of God's rule. I will be my own God. The moment I establish myself as my own God, then everything that I am and everything that I have is the thing that defines me. And therefore, because it's the thing that defines me, it is the thing that I must protect viciously. And yet Paul says, don't be haughty. If you're rich, and I just define rich from, if you're an American, you're more than likely rich here. It may be at varying levels, but we don't set our hopes on our financial stability. We don't set our hopes on our intellectual capacity. We don't set our hopes on our artistic, aesthetic imaginations. We set our hopes on something bigger than any of that, which actually gives life a forward movement towards something that is sane and solid and stable. This is why Jesus said, how hard is it for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven? Because it's easy to lose sight of God when you have everything that you ever wanted. It's difficult to preach the gospel to a people that have no need for him. Let's go to the next slide. Secondly, humility is not simply a recognition that everything you are and everything you have belongs to him, but it is worked out, and here's the practical nuts and bolts of how we combat pride. It's worked out in a daily surrender to Jesus as Lord. Because to say Jesus is Lord is to say, I am what? Not. To say Jesus is Lord, and it's a daily responsibility. Every day lies before us the choice. Will I choose the narrow path that leads to righteousness, or will I choose the wide path where that leads to destruction, that many go in by, including followers? It's the decision today. I will make every decision based upon myself as the grid from which I will work. Or no, today I get on my knees and I surrender to Jesus. What does Paul say in Romans 12? I beseech you, brothers and sisters, I beg you, brothers and sisters, present yourself as a living sacrifice. What does it mean to present yourself as a living sacrifice? What is a sacrifice? It is something that is what? Killed. If it's a sacrificial lamb, the lamb doesn't get off the altar. The lamb dies. So what does that mean? Is this self-forgetfulness? Is it self-annihilation? Is it the eradication of the personality? What does it mean to surrender to Jesus? This is the question that people often ask me. If I surrender, do I lose myself? I mean, I don't want to lose who I am. No, it's not about losing yourself. Without Jesus, you are lost. Giving yourself to Christ, surrender to him is what leads us to a revelation of what God intended us to be, which we can never discover until we're linked to the source of life himself. This is why it says, before I had Jesus, I was dead in my sins and trespasses. And so we have to understand this, is that daily surrender is a daily responsibility, because as the gospel sets us free, every day we must make the choice. Either Jesus is going to be king, or you're going to be king. And if you're king, you're setting yourself up for heartbreak. You can go to the next slide. I love this quote from G.K. Chesterton. Complete self-confidence is not merely a sin. Complete self-confidence is a weakness. And isn't it true that those who are the most confident that they are the most awesome thing in the room, everyone seems to be in on the joke but them? Have you ever noticed that? Maybe you haven't, because you're that person. We don't know. If you're in a group of friends, we're probably too passive aggressive to tell you to your face. So then you're just stuck in weakness. Humility, third, is evidenced by a disposition of thankfulness. So, all joking aside, we recognize that God is the foundation by which I owe my existence, all that I have, it belongs to him. And we make that recognition manifest in our lives by a daily surrender. I surrender to you, Jesus. I want your will be done, not my mind done. It's so simple. And to make his will our will is to make his thoughts our thoughts. It's to saturate ourselves in prayer and in the word. It's to live with a constant awareness that Jesus is with us and for us and not against us. This, like Nebuchadnezzar, if he's willing to move into Nebuchadnezzar's life and actually intervene in the most proud, arrogant human being who actually exalted himself as a God, what kind of God is this? It's a God who chooses to love sinners in their sin. And we should take great encouragement in the fact that God was willing to mercifully intervene in Nebuchadnezzar's existence. Nebuchadnezzar was grateful for it. And that's the thing, is that humility. How do you know if you're humble? Well, you're not supposed to sit around and think about being humble. But I will tell you, there is a litmus test, and it struck me. I've been reading through Karl Barth's Dogmatics with a group of the pastors, and in his volume on reconciliation, he said the essence or the opposite of sin is thankfulness. And I think humility is evidenced by a disposition of thankfulness. I want to just share with you guys in closing, because this is the end, is that I went through a season of severe, severe anxiety. I had my own Nebuchadnezzar meltdown. 8 months it lasted. It began at the beginning of year 2 of Door of Hope. Door of Hope had grown so fast, I was the only preacher, and I was the worship leader. I did all the worship, all the teaching. And it was growing faster than I could keep my head around. And in growing, I didn't realize that pride was making its mark in my life. Because if I was to define pride as I am my own God, pride doesn't necessarily mean you think you're awesome. Pride just means you think about you. So you could be miserably proud. Or you could be, you know, arrogantly proud. So people are just like, no, you were humble. I went to church that... Hear me out. When I say I was proud, I was saying that I believed that the success or the failure of the church was dependent upon my ability. And so when I'd have a bad sermon, I would lose sleep for days, convinced that nobody's going to come back the next week. And you know how God cured me of that? He let me have a whole series of bad sermons. And some of you were here and you're nodding. Yes, yes, you did. I remember the I Am Who I Am series. Worst series I've ever given. Remember, even so bad, my wife had to tell me it was bad in the middle of it. I still had like 3 left to go. And she's like, honey, this series, it's just not connecting with my heart. And I'm like, dang it. And that led to even more sleepless nights. But it started with insomnia that was led by a stress that was built upon a false belief that I was responsible for what God was doing. And that insomnia, when you don't sleep, you're not stable. Insomnia led to an anxiety, an undefinable sense that something was horribly wrong. And that's a terrifying feeling, guys. I used to be so hard on people that struggled with depression or anxiety. I'm like, you just don't believe in Jesus. And then the Lord's like, here, boom. And that anxiety kept growing and increasing. And it grew to the point where I would have emotional breakdowns. And I would just break down weeping constantly. By the last few months, I was breaking down, crying, and I don't cry easily. I actually might have some sociopathic tendencies because I have a hard time being emotional. And that may be hard to believe because I'm intense. Doesn't mean I'm emotional. And so that's Darcy's famous line. Do you not feel anything? I just don't know how to actually respond to what I'm feeling. That's another kind of, probably some sort of mental dysfunction. But I at this time, I cried enough then to not have to cry for the rest of my life. Because I would worship practice. I'd leave the stage to go cry in my office and then come back and pretend like I was fine. Preaching. People are still getting saved. The church is still growing. And I'm dying. And it ended with me going to a cabin and fasting and praying for 2 days. And at the end of those 2 days, I found myself walking through a field and I was just wrestling with God, literally like talking out loud to God for 2 days straight, water, nothing else. And I go out into this field, it's on the Deschutes River, and there's a bend in the river and there is this open field. And I knelt down in the middle of this field, and like Nebuchadnezzar in his insanity, I fell down on the ground and I sobbed and I just started yelling at God, like, why? Why? And it was the first time in my life that the Lord, and the only time actually up to this point, the Lord supernaturally gave me, the only thing I could call is a vision. And the way I would describe it was that in one moment, as I was complaining against God, and complaining about my lot and my anxieties and so frustrated and so scared. I was scared. I thought I was going crazy. And I was. And the Lord showed me my life from the moment that I met him. That 2 years into my marriage on the verge of a divorce, arrogant, egocentric, wannabe rock star who'd already been dropped from his label and seen all his dreams dash, whose wife was completely disenchanted with him, that Jesus reached down into my life and miraculously saved me. Nobody preached the gospel, and I just opened up a Bible, and the reality, it was like a stinking hologram practically. Jesus was so real to me when I read through the gospels that I was like, I don't know anything, but I know that this is the guy I need to know. And I gave my life to Jesus, and it was a radical transformation. The 2 years later, God would have brought me into a community that would have reached my wife, who got radically saved, and then to be given our beautiful son, Henry. And then from that, to see the Lord, music had been taken away from me, and then all of a sudden, it was given back to me in a new form, and I was writing like 5-6 songs a week of just worship songs, because I was so overwhelmed with a sense of awe at this Jesus who saved me. And from there, to be brought into full-time ministry after only being a believer for two years and my wife a believer for 6 months, and then to travel around the world for an entire year, 250 shows between 2003 and 2004, playing and sharing the gospel with people and discovering a desire to teach, to be moved to the wasteland of the Inland Empire of California, and to be trained in the wilderness of toil and heat and dirt and stucco, before being brought back to Portland, and there in that wasteland, given our beautiful daughter after two miscarriages, given the beauty of Hattie, and to be brought back to the city which we loved and grew up in, and have been a part of, being true Northwesterners, to be brought back to the beautiful, green, wet Portland, and to start the church. God showed it all to me like a deck of cards being played out, like a fan just. And he showed me that when all of the anxiety started, when all of the insomnia came, I stopped thanking him. He showed me everything in my life. He's like, you aren't even the same man. You're not even recognizable, physically recognizable from what you were before I saved you. I've put pictures up before of me and my makeup. I don't look like the same man, literally. And God's like, this is where I brought you from here to here, and all you're doing is complaining. You lost sight of me. You stopped being thankful, Josh. And I just wept, and I said, Lord, I'm sorry. And then I just began to thank him for everything I could think of, and it was just the list. It was like I had had a blockage for 8 months, and it just broke open, and the thanksgiving flowed out, and literally within 2 weeks, the insomnia was completely gone. The anxiety was gone. It wasn't without help of going to a doctor, getting healthy, getting back on a normal sleep schedule. I don't want you to think it was a completely supernatural healing. When people are that broken, we're complex beings. We're physical. We're spiritual. We're psychological. We need all of those elements to be addressed. But God did a miracle that day. And I realize this today is that the essence of sin and the outcome of pride is that we become unthankful. Nebuchadnezzar believed he was responsible for what he had accomplished, only to find himself turned into a maniac, because that is the only outcome for those that would elevate themselves to the position of God. True humility in the church has found that all of a sudden the world around you is more important than what is going on in your little universe. And how much larger would our world be if we were smaller in it, said Chesterton. And I pray today that we would understand that what is desperately needed in the church is that we humble ourselves, because Jesus, the gospel teaches us thanksgiving. It teaches us humility, because we're told that Jesus himself, God in the flesh, God incarnate, that God, he gave up the glory of heaven and he humbled himself and became a man. And in the flesh, he bent sinful, broken flesh back into righteousness to the Father. And it says, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the shame. He shows us what humility is, and that he was thankful that he could give up his life for you and I. That's humility. Without a right understanding of the gospel, we'll never be thankful. But once we realize what it costs God to be in communion with us, how can we be anything but thankful? This is the lesson of Daniel 4. Humble yourself before the Lord, and he will in due time exalt you. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, thank you for the gospel, its ability to bring transformation into our lives. I pray, Lord, that you would change us, transform us, renew us, guide us, direct us by your Spirit. Forgive us, Lord, for our pride, for our egos. Forgive us for being more concerned about what's going on in our little lives than the lives of those around us. Lord, may we test our humility by asking the question, am I truly thankful? And Lord, for those who recognize that there's been no thanksgiving, that their heart has been hardened toward you and toward your people, that their lives are marked more by disappointment and discouragement, their inability to face trials because they have no foundation in you, I pray that in your mercy, you would reveal to them just how much you love them, even on their worst day. Because Lord, even in brokenness, even in pain, even in sickness, there are still things to be thankful for because you have not left us nor forsaken us. That this life is not all that there is, but there will be a day when we will give an account before you, our Maker. May we acknowledge you now. May we learn humility, not through the school of humiliation, but Lord, if that's what it takes to get our attention, then do it. Do whatever it takes to make us men and women after your heart. Jesus, make yourself known, we pray in your name. Amen.